Welcome to the first Music Industry Forum podcast of 2009. This episode is brought to you by Music Grow Search. Music Grow Search is a full-service executive recruiting firm specializing in the placement of music industry executives. For more information, visit musicgrowsearch.com. This week on the podcast, Tom talks to Garrett Leonhard, media futurist of mediafuturist.com. He's the author of Music 2.0 and The Future of Music. Enjoy the show.
Garrett, good morning. Thank you for making yourself available to the Music Industry Forum bi-weekly newsletter. How are you doing today?
Great. Doing good. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. For our listeners out there, do me a favor. Give us a brief introduction of kind of who you are and how you got into the music industry originally.
Well, I have to make it very brief then, otherwise it'll be the whole time. Now, I started as a musician and producer. I went to Berklee College in the 80s. And then quickly in the 90s, I started doing stuff on the web, running digital music companies, including a company called LicenseMusic.com. This was in the internet bust years. And so I've been involved with digital music pretty much since the first day, since 94, 93 even. And ever since about 2002, after the internet crash, I've been working as a futurist for media and technology companies. So basically my job is to explain to both parties, so the content guys and the tech guys, and of course the internet companies, to how they can work together to create new business models for digital content. And my emphasis about, I would say about 60-70% of my work is in music, but I also work in film, television, gaming, print publishing, and advertising.
It's all media and all entertainment, isn't it?
Yep. And I also wrote a few books. One is called The Future of Music, which was in 2005 together with Dave Cusack. And that's become sort of a classic that everybody in the music industry has read. And a new book called Music 2.0, which is available for free at music20thebook.com. And I'm working on the third book, which I'll announce when it's ready.
Fantastic. Here's a question about the 2005 book. If you had to write that book again today, how different might it be given what's transpired over the last 4 years?
That's a very good question. It's kind of sad that many things in the book are actually either became true or are actually still true or being changed right now. So most of the things that we talked about in the book, like the idea of music as a service, the mobile phone taken over as a prime device, you know, those were all in the book. And I don't think they were rocket science to predict, but they've become true. The dropping of DRM. I would think that if I had to write it again, I would probably go out a little bit further into the future. But at the same time, it looks like it's just taken a little bit longer, but now the changes are even bigger than anticipated, which is kind of interesting.
You're very prophetic. Let's stay on cellular phones for a second, because obviously that seems to be the preeminent device, shall I say, that we all carry, and all entertainment companies are trying to put their products therein. What do you see most immediately, the good and the bad for music on cell phones?
Well, I think that's pretty much only good, because of course a good thing on the cell phone is that people are ready to pay, to make payments. Because the cell phone culture is whole completely different than the internet-based, computer-based culture. So on the mobile phone, people pay for applications, they pay for software, they pay for SMS, they pay for all kinds of things. And content, you know, if it's cleverly packaged, I think can be paid for as well, including, of course, you know, upselling to tickets and location-based services and all these kind of things that have become sort of second nature to people in Europe and Asia already. You know, people buy Coke cans in Finland using the mobile phone. So that is all good news. I think in general what we're looking at is that music as a service, of course, is like very natural fit for the mobile phone. So in other words, you know, to click on Pandora or Last.fm or iMeme or whatever on your mobile phone is becoming essentially a substitute of even downloading music. And so the chances of making money with it are drastically increased when you can bundle it. And that is sort of the whole thesis behind my first book and my second book, which is that music has to be a bundled service into operators and ISPs and so on.
You know, Gary, there's some people out there that feel like people should just give the music away for free and just kind of let technology blow it, you know, through the world like the wind. Where are you on giving music away?
Oh, I think it's a bit of an academic question, because in the end, you know, how we make money with music will never be just subject to one channel or one way of doing it, especially not in this world, because all cultures have different behaviors, right? So some people will buy copies and physical products, and most people will not. But money can be made in all different permutations of music, including, of course, live shows, webcasts, online access, fan sites, donations, games, interactive things, right? So I think that it feels like free model, as I like to call it. Feels like free means that payment is being made, but I don't really notice it. It's not such an active decision as iTunes. You know, I love iTunes, I love Apple, but an active decision of buying one song at a time, most people just won't do it because the pain level is too high. If it was 10 cents, it would be different, right? But for a dollar, that's kind of a hard decision. So I believe in a feels-like-free model. And feels-like-free to me is the same as Google and Gmail, you know, free software, free products, but money is being made. Skype, which feels like free, but people still pay. Flickr, you know, which upsells 5% of Flickr, takes the pro version. And many, many other things. I think that the feels-like-free model is the way to go, to draw people in on the first level and then convert them to many, many others.
Who are, in your estimation, are some of the companies that are going to win in that, shall we say, next chapter of the war?
Well, I think the main problem is that in terms of who will win and make this work, right now you can't win in music, basically, because you need permission of the content owners that are using 50-year-old laws to do business, which I understand why they're doing this, and of course it's a big change for them as well. But you know, you just can't get permission for a lot of these models like Project Playlist or Songza or Muxtape and so on, right? I mean, we just can't get permission to create a new structure. So the problem is that we have a very one-sided law that provides for exclusive ownership, exclusive rights, exclusive pricing. And then we have the users who are not anywhere near that, right? So we have a disparity here. I think that is the biggest problem, and this is why I think that a collective license for music, and if needed, a voluntary or compulsory collective, would solve the problem of the market not functioning right now.
Do you think that's possible on a global basis, or is it going to be country by country?
I think it'll be country by country initially, or even what are called private flat rates, like companies like Nokia are doing this, you know, negotiating their own flat rates for what comes with music. But as you can see right now, Warner Music is doing this with Jim Griffin, pushing out a flat rate to universities so that every university student is legal by definition, but just having signed up to be a student. The Isle of Man is launching a flat rate for all of their ISP customers, you know, the small island of England, between England and Ireland, and so many more. So what we're seeing here is a way of saying, you know, we have to figure out this ecosystem together. There's no single company is going to put the money on the table for music, right? This has to be created together between the ISPs, the brands, the content owners, the governments, and of course the big advertisers.
Garrett, let's talk about specific artists that you think are doing some novel things to stand out in this mess right now. Who are, in your estimation, are using technology adroitly and intelligently? And who could improve in doing that?
Well, I think there, you know, the good news is that many, many artists are now understanding that technology gives them a direct lead to their fans and the customers in the end. And so you have tons of artists. I mean, you have several 10,000 artists now on Twitter, which many people consider the ultimate time-wasting machine, and it can be. But Twitter is a great way to sort of broadcast to your fans. So anything from Britney Spears to Dell Computers and the New York Times, yeah, are now on Twitter. And, you know, if you're a label or an artist and you don't have a Twitter channel, I think you're missing the boat. And I've written about this in my blog. So that's one big thing that I see. And I see bands like Groove Armada, you know, the electronic DJ band, making a deal with Bacardi, you know, for online downloading, for sharing their stuff. I see Terry McBride over at Network Records, you know, doing fantastic things with his artists, like licensing his music or their music to companies like RockU and Slide.com so that you can sync videos with it. So all these, you know, these are all pointing in the right directions. And once we have the agreement of the larger music companies to actually open up, I think the whole thing could just could very much explode again.
Garrett, at MIDEM this year in France, you gave a couple of really interesting presentations. Can you talk to your presentation in more detail regarding Feels Like Free?
Yeah, I mean, basically the overriding subject of what I talked about was the idea of compensation, not control. Because, you know, in the past, we've basically used the mechanism of controlling the market so that we can get money out of it. In other words, distribution control, promotion control, radio control, and, of course, artist control is what most labels use to monetize, right? Today, we have to switch this around. We have to say, well, we can't really control what the user does with the music, because if we do so, then they won't listen. And therefore, we have to turn the use into compensation, which means providing the licenses. So big part of my presentation at MIDEM was about how we can make this work. How can we generate money out of a system that's seemingly out of control, or at least to some degree with less control? And that includes, of course, getting the ISPs involved and creating a solution together. And that was a big part of my MIDEM presentation, is to not look for the ISPs to pay, not look for taxes to pay, not look for the user to pay exclusively, but to create something that is basically an ecosystem, which I think is right here on our doorstep.
Yeah, intellectually it makes so much sense. Why are we having so much trouble getting all the stakeholders to come together and do this?
Well, the music industry has traditionally been a very secluded business with many secrets and total lack of transparency. And unfortunately, also a lot of people who just don't know what in the world is going on outside of their office, right? I mean, they're basically, you know, an old-fashioned way, as you would say, that's a mogul sort of state of mind, you know, the world according to XYZ. And if you come from the internet, you come from the exact opposite view of the world, right? So you have to collaborate, you create things together. The Google business model was created by Google as they were going, you know, not before. And the same will go for Twitter and for many others. So it's a paradigm shift to where you have to let go of the idea that you can run the whole thing by yourself and make all of the money. Now it's about sharing and about figuring out how to do it together and about transparency. I mean, this is where the whole economy is moving this direction, right? It's not just music. So music has the biggest problem because of this state of mind of being like, you know, it's all ours and, you know, we won't tell you what the deal is.
Sure sounds easy to do here in this conversation, but when you get all those stakeholders around the table, they sure look like looks like a land grab.
Yeah, well, in a way, it's basically there's little way forward but to figure it out together, because if we go forward without being together, then we just crash against the wall. I mean, as we can see right now with the major labels, you know, EMI is rebuilding, and I sure hope they make it, and if anybody deserves it, I think they do. But if you look at the other labels, you know, I think it's going to be extremely difficult with this attitude to turn things around unless you come down to the bottom line and say, hey, you know, we get it and we're going to do something different. We don't need the IFPI or the RLA to sell music, you know, that we just don't need that anymore.
You know, you mentioned specifically a moment ago Jim Griffin and Warner doing a deal with universities. Where are the other three majors in that same conversation?
Well, I think that the major labels all know that the flat rate would be a fantastic thing for them, because they would essentially get paid just by process of people entering the internet. And even better, of course, the users themselves wouldn't even pay, because there's enough money in the system, just like Google has shown with their system, to actually pay for the music. So the thing is that when they do this, they lose control of distribution, because distribution will be built in, right? So in that case, that is the only loss they have, which is much more sort of a paradigm loss than a financial loss. And I think Jim is trying to explain that to Warner, and it seems like it has some backing there. The other labels, I think, of course, they have conversations, and I think they also see it as inevitable. But, you know, we don't have leadership there. That is our biggest problem. We don't have a Steve Jobs in the music business. We don't have an Obama, you know, somebody who could come up and kick people's butts and speak the truth. You know, we don't have that there. We have mostly people who just don't know. And so I'm looking, you know, maybe that will change this year because of economic relationships.
I hope you're right. Kurt, you just made a great point about that leadership vacuum in the music industry. You know, we don't have a Jobs or an Obama. Why is that in your estimation? And what's going to change that?
Well, there's a great saying that says, you know, when the pain gets big enough, the vision gets going. And, you know, what we had in the music business is the substantial, huge amounts of profits made off the CD sales, which were a fluke, you know, for the industry, essentially selling again what was already sold before, right? So we had a 18-year stretch of enormous amounts of money being made by doing very little in the end. Right. And so that led to this bloating of the industry where you could just do something and it would make money by itself. Right. And because of that, the attitude was, you know, music industry is basically, you know, it's if it works, it just explodes and you get lots of money and you have all the control. And now with the internet for the last 10 years, it has completely eroded. Now the control is with the user. So the culture of the music industry has not been all about internal innovation or understanding the customer, which there has been zero of as compared to, say, games or television, right? And that has to be reinvented. I think this is going to be the year 2009 where lots of new people will come forward. And I see many of them all over the place, but they're not being empowered yet. And so that is because, of course, a lot of the old power is still in the old places. And I do think that our lobby groups that we have, not our, but their lobby groups, like the BPI or the RFPI or the RA, have become useless appendixes to the industry that basically just suck the energy and the money out and put it in the wrong direction, like they do here in Europe now with the discussion of disconnecting internet users if they have been watched and observed as downloading.
A lot of what you're telling us is all about giving up that control, isn't it? So your book is aptly named.
Yeah, my new book is The End of Control, but that's still in process. I haven't gotten quite control of it yet.
It's the beginning of the end of control.
You know, the question is not so much, I mean, you can't make money if you don't have any control, right? I mean, that's also quite clear, as Google and Skype and many other ones have shown us. But in this world, if you push for total control and dominance, you end up with nothing because people will basically circumvent you. So the clever companies like eBay, Amazon, many others, you know, that's what they do. They empower us to voluntarily give some of the control back to them. And thereby they make money. So with this model, the music industry just hasn't gotten around to it yet because they always want the money and the control. And, you know, not to rant on this too much, but I think that is basically, that is the paradigm change that we have to get involved with.
On a personal level, let me ask you a couple of general questions. First, what section of the Sunday New York Times do you read first? If you read that paper, by the way.
Well, I read the physical paper at the airport, but otherwise I read the Herald Tribune, which is also the New York Times, really the same thing. I do have the New York Times iPhone app, which I really love. And, of course, I read the tech news and the advertising marketing stuff first. But, you know, my reading habits are about 850 RSS feeds and 2,000 friends on Twitter. And that's basically how I get all the stuff that I need. And I read lots of books, of course, by the way. So I buy about 5-6 books a month, and that's basically how I keep myself tuned up.
What kind of music do you like to listen to? What's on your iPod right now?
Podcasts. I have to admit, because, you know, I was a musician and a guitar player for 15 years, and I studied composition and everything, that when I listen to music, I pay attention to it. And so, therefore, I can't actually do it when I'm working. And that cuts back on a lot of my music listening. But in the car, you know, I have a very broad range, ranging from sort of John Mayer, you know, rock stuff, all the way to jazz fusion, Miles Davis, John Coltrane. World music. I love Cuban music. And I mean, I have a pretty wide taste depending on what the occasion is.
Indeed. Gerd, listen, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to the audience. I know this is going to be a very interesting podcast for people to download, and I bet it's going to increase some traffic for your, hopefully, your book sales and your blogs and everything else.
That's good.
Lastly, let me say just thank you for the voice of reason that you are demonstrating in this crazy industry we call the music business.
You're welcome. And a final word, if people want to download my book, the Music 2.0 book, it's available for free at music20thebook.com, music20thebook.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks to Gary for being on the program this week. If you're a member of the music industry and you're on LinkedIn, join the Music Industry Forum. Go to groups and search for Music Industry Forum. We'd love to see you there. And for those listeners in Nashville, we have a networking event coming up February 18th, 5 to 7 p.m., which is happy hour, at the Listening Room Cafe in Cumming Station. Come by and say hi. We'd love to see you there. Until next time, thanks.